Cory Booker has written a book about his life, and we'll talk to him about it.
Major funding for On the Record with Michael Aaron is provided by the members of the New Jersey Education Association, making public schools great for every child. NJM, auto insurance and more, for New Jersey Business and Industry Association members, their employees, and all Garden State public sector workers. Rowan University, educating New Jersey leaders, partnering with New Jersey businesses, transforming New Jersey's future. And by the Fuel Merchants Association of New Jersey, the National Oil Heat Research Alliance, and BioHeat, the evolution of oil heat. Promotional support is provided by Politicker NJ, providing news and insight to New Jersey's political community.
I'm Michael Aaron. Cory Booker is a pretty familiar figure by now in New Jersey politics, but if you think you know all about him, you need to pick up his book. It's called United, and it's part autobiography, part policy book, part philosophy book, and Cory Booker is our guest this week. Senator, I enjoyed this read. It was a chance to learn a lot more about you.
I appreciate that.
It opens with you on the Finding Your Roots show with Henry Louis Gates Jr., learning that you're the descendant of slaves and at least one slave owner, maybe more.
Yes.
Is that something you still think about today, or do you just kind of absorb that information and move forward?
Well, I think the powerful point that I learned in exploring that chapter was one that I am not only a descendant of slave and slave owners, but I'm a descendant of Native Americans and people that fought in the Alabama Creek War, kicking Native Americans off their lands. Skip Gates was able to trace my history to coming to this country in 1640, which is amazing to me, around the time of, you know, people landing on Plymouth Rock, for
crying out loud. You're a blue blood.
I am. So, but what was powerful about that, he actually found, you know, my grandfather, who's clearly biracial, but his siblings were not, a lot darker than he was, he actually, through DNA tests, found my mom's first cousin and reunited us with a white family who had no idea they had a black branch. And so at first it was a testimony to how really much more connected we are as Americans than we think we are. But then the second part of the chapter that weaves in and out really starts with this embarrassing reality that for that show he put me with John Lewis, this hero of the civil rights movement who marched on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And then when I went to find out about how I got to New Jersey, that literally there was the Fair Housing Council, blacks and whites, who helped to integrate Bergen County, literally fought a big physical contest at the end for my parents to get a contract to buy the house we moved into. What I found out is those lawyers in New Jersey, why did they do what they did? It was because of these marchers on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And they were so inspired by that that they turned around and decided to help black families.
Your parents had a lawyer with a Jewish name who was fighting to get them housing in Bergen County, and he got into a fist fight with the realtor who tried to tell your parents that the house was sold but then told a white couple it was available.
And they didn't know that the white couple was really a test couple for the Fair Housing Council to expose the real estate discrimination at the time in the 60s and 70s.
Why do you think your parents wanted so much to integrate a white suburb or be trailblazers in a white suburb?
Well, I think what one of the things I'm trying to show about this chapter is that we're all part of this conspiracy of love, that here is, we have no understanding of the causal connections from our good deeds. Here are people in the civil rights movement in Alabama. On the very instant they decide to stand up for justice, they change the minds of some white lawyers in New Jersey, who then change the destinies of black families. It's this powerful causal connection of love that no good deed in a righteous cause, even if you fail, because remember, they failed to get across that bridge the first time. It may seem like a failure in the moment, but really you ignite a blaze of goodness that illuminates generations yet unborn. And so my parents wanted to be a part of the conspiracy of love. They knew that they were where they were. My parents were hardworking, successful IBM executives, but they knew my father was the first African American hired in the Virginia area, not just because he was qualified, but because of whites and blacks willing to work together to make that happen. They opened up opportunities because of civil rights activists. My father, born poor, was able to make it out of poverty because of the good deeds and acts of other people. So my parents said, look, you're here because of those important American values of rugged individualism and self-reliance, but at the end of the day, America's a story. We didn't get where we are because of rugged individualism. We didn't get to the moon because of rugged individualism. We got here because of good people learning to work together and sacrifice together to advance our nation.
You use the phrase interwoven destinies. The theme of this book is that we all have interwoven destinies.
Yeah.
Your parents, from what you write, both of them kept you grounded. Your father said, don't walk around like you hit a triple. You were born on third base.
Yes.
Which one of them gave you your drive?
I am, the older we get, the more we see ourselves becoming like our parents. I think the best quote from James Baldwin is, children are never good at listening to their elders, but they never fail to imitate them. And both of my parents, which was interesting to me growing up in a, you know, relative to other places, very privileged community, my parents were people that felt this nation had advanced so much but wasn't achieved yet. So they both wanted my brother and I to be a part of the unfolding story of America, trying to be what we say we are, a land of liberty and justice for all. So this was the cereal we ate with the lectures that we got as a kid. Kids were about our obligations, not to, as my father would say, get fat, dumb, and happy just consuming all of these blessings. My father said you should be consuming these things to metabolize in your system, to be energy to continue the fight for this country. So by the time I was a teenager, I was well programmed by my parents, and I'm grateful for that. They planted seeds that would later really, I think, bear the fruit of my life.
You went to Stanford, you went to Oxford, you went to Yale Law School, and then you came and settled in Newark, and you chose to live in one of the most drug-infested parts of the Central Ward in the city. Why did you want to live right in the heart of despair?
Well, at this point, I'd lived everywhere from East Harlem, worked everywhere from East Harlem to East Palo Alto, but Newark was a city that, as I explained, that was sort of, I felt like it was my destiny. And I landed in this community, and I have to confess, you make it sound like some brave, bold thing, but I land there and I was overwhelmed. I mean, I was robbed in my first moments there. Things were stolen from my car as I was moving in. And, you know, there's an old saying that, you know, when you come to the end of all the light you know and are about to step into the darkness, that faith is one of two things is going to happen. Faith is believing that one of two things is going to happen. Either you'll find solid ground underneath you, or the universe will send you people who will teach you how to fly. And so I met some amazing heroes. It changed my life. I always say I got my BA from Stanford, but my PhD on the streets of Newark. And perhaps one of the greatest heroes for me was a tough, sometimes seemingly honorary tenant leader from those buildings named Miss Virginia Jones. And she knocked me down to size, as you know, a young man probably bordering on arrogance who thought he was just gonna roll in and transform things. She really set me straight in the earliest moments of my life, really knocked me down and then built me up in a way that I'm forever grateful.
What did she see in you, do you think?
Well, that's a wonderful thing about writing a book, is that I thought I knew the stories. And then when you go back, I interviewed tenant leaders from that time. I interviewed guys, you know, some of them just coming out of prison who used to deal drugs on that street, then in their teens and 20s, now in their 40s and some of them 50s, just to get all their perspectives on me showing up in that community. And what was amazing to me is I thought Ms. Jones had no patience for me. She really pushed me away. I showed up, I'm a Yale law student, I'm here to help you. And she's sort of like giving me the stiff arm. But when I'm starting to interview people, I was blown away, and actually got me very sort of emotional all over again when I was hearing from other tenant leaders who said, you don't understand this. When she first met you, you may have felt like she was pushing you away, but she turned to us right away and said, that's my son. And then some of the guys who I had very tough conflicts with when I first arrived on that street, I went back and interviewed a lot of the guys that were dealing drugs at the time, and they said to me stories like, Ms. Jones came to us and told us to leave you alone because you were family. And so one of the most powerful things, quotes, that ever been said to me was when I first arrived in those in that community and I was overwhelmed by what was around me, and Ms. Jones took me aside, and this was when I felt like she was giving me the stiff arm, and she said, boy, you know, tell me what you see in this neighborhood. And I go, what do you mean? She goes, describe the neighborhood. And I described the crack house that was on the street, the projects. And the more I talked, the more disgusted she looked with me. And she said, you know, she interrupted me and she said, you can't help me. And then she starts walking away, and I grab her, very respectfully, mind you, and I'm like, what are you talking about? I can't help you. And she goes, you need to understand something, that the world you see outside of you is a reflection of what you have inside of you. And if you're one of these people who only sees problems and darkness and despair, that's all there's ever going to be. But if you're stubborn and you see hope, love, the face of God, then you can help me.
There are a lot of truisms in this book. I underlined every time I came across a truism. That's one of the truisms. Say it again about what you see outside is a reflection of what you are inside.
Yeah, but we all know that. And this is not only about a neighborhood. So many people see Newark in ways, and this, by the time I got into politics, it used to frustrate me going around this community, that they see negativity, and they don't understand that's more a reflection of them. We are where we are in America because amidst real challenges, often wretched despair, people refuse to see that. They still saw hope, they still saw opportunity, and because of their sight, because of their vision, they made it real. Newark is a testimony, not to mayors and whatever, it's a testimony to grassroots folks who, when other people were giving up and abandoning their city, they refused to give up on the promise of it. And this extends to each other. If I was down in Washington right now, who every time I saw a Republican, I saw them as, oh, this is a Republican. Oh, I can't work with this person. Oh, look how negative they are. That's a more reflection of who I am than who they are. As opposed to seeing, you know what? We're both Americans. Our differences matter, but our country matters more. I'm going to find a way to work with you. And that's what Ms. Jones taught me.
You were so idealistic at 27 when you came to Newark. Are you still as idealistic as you were back then?
More so. I mean, I could write a whole book, that's why a lot of Newark stories in there, about the gifts that this city gave me. And one of them is, what is the definition of hope? Most people think hope is just, oh, I'm so idealistic, everything is nice and sunny. That's not hope. In fact, that's unfortunate. Those are the people that want to sort of whitewash American history and remove from it all the wretched negativity. What Newarkers taught me, and what Ms. Jones, one of the principal teachers, taught me, is that hope is a response. Hope is confronts. It sees the challenges and the difficulties and the despair even. And hope is the active conviction that despair will not have the last word. Hope is a response. And that's why hope is so courageous. And so, in many ways, through my experiences in Newark, which are, for me, unique in the United States Senate, remember, I'm the 21st person since 1789 ever to go straight from being a mayor of a big city to being a United States Senator. It's a very unusual path. And Newark's gift to me was really the gift of hope, that as I've seen things, I still live in the Central Ward right down from
Do you still live in the Central Ward of Newark?
Still live in the Central Ward right down from Brick Towers. And what the Senate taught me, what Newark taught me, is the power of hope to really see the challenges of our country, to live experiences that some of my Senate colleagues may not have actually lived, but to still believe in the promise of our country.
You have a quote towards the end of the book from Daniel Webster, "Let our age be the age of improvement," probably written in the 1850s.
Yes.
Do you think we're still improving, or have we hit a dead end as a society, or are we in trouble as a society?
So please understand that every moment is a moment, in my opinion, a moment of urgency and crisis. But remember, that Chinese symbol for crisis is danger and opportunity. So we are always at that moment. Every generation is at that moment where we could take a terrible turn into demagoguery, into divisiveness. Everybody from Father Conklin to McCarthyism to some of the vile streams we're seeing in our political culture today.
You're referring to Donald Trump?
I don't want to personalize it, because okay. you diffuse it when you make it about a person. These are the two angels that wrestle within all of us, the dark angels and the angels of light that wrestle within all of us. I've been, and I admit this freely in the book, I try to illustrate when I've been a jerk, when I've given in to my lesser angels, when I haven't lived up to my promise. But there's always a choice, and the choice we have as Americans is to accept things as they are or take responsibility for changing them. And so I see this as probably one of the most hopeful and promising periods in our American culture, and I can give you lots of reasons why, but I'm very conscious of the unfinished business, how we are pouring our greatest natural resource, our children, we're pouring their potential down the sewer by not cultivating it, nurturing it. We're allowing things to fester, like a broken criminal justice system, the poisoning. I talk about the poisoning of our communities by things like Superfund sites, which are growing in our country. So we have a choice to make right now. Which America will we be? The America that's hopeful, that confronts problems and injustice, but chooses a way away from them, or that descends into divisiveness?
I want to get into those things, but one more footnote, a political footnote, really, from the book that I just think was interesting. Many of our viewers know who Ray Chambers is, a great philanthropist who has done a lot for Newark over the years. You went to him when you were thinking of forming a nonprofit. You were fresh out of law school and you wanted to form a nonprofit and do good works. And you also needed some advice on your love life. And he gave you the advice on your love life and then said, but we don't need another nonprofit in Newark. We need a mayor. You write that he's the one who put the thought into your head that you should run for mayor someday?
Yeah, he's the first person that looked me in the eye and very determinedly said that. I blame him still to this day. Ray, if you're listening, I'm blaming you for being single. No, but he joked, he in a stunning way, like, had to give you advice about my personal life. But then, as I write, but then he shifts and looks at me and just says, you know, this Newark needs political blood, new political blood needs change. And I rejected both of his pieces of advice. And in fact, left there thinking, I'm going to show this guy, I'm going to show him by creating an amazing nonprofit in the city, and I'm going to show him by marrying this woman. And so it was one of those times that people almost predictively tell you what your future is, but you refuse to accept it. In fact, you react very negatively. I was very angry at him.
All right, let's get back to we're poisoning our children. Here in Newark, over the past week, we've learned of lead in nearly half the school building drinking water. It's sort of a mini Flint, or at least that's how the media is setting it up. The numbers aren't quite as high as in Flint.
Well, let's put those numbers in perspective. This is about 15-20 parts per billion versus Flint, which was 13,000 parts per billion.
It goes up to 500 parts per billion in some of these Newark schools.
And my point is deeper than this, which is if we keep trying to react to a crisis when it's discovered, please understand that Camden is still has water bottles being delivered to schools. We have an aging infrastructure in this country right now, especially in urban areas, especially in poor areas, that we have not invested in fixing. And as a result of that, there are 500,000 children poisoned by lead. 500,000 children in the country every single year. I talk about lead, and I wrote this last chapter about lead before the issue in the water came forward, because Newark has been battling lead paint problems since the time before I was a city council person. And so one of the biggest calls I call for environmentally at the end of the book is this understanding that if terrorists came in and kidnapped a bunch of children or did something in one school, we would probably as a society rise up and spend millions and millions of dollars on homeland security and on bars and guns and what have you. But we live in a culture right now where we are unequivocally, Princeton studies are showing that every state has Superfund sites, we're not cleaning them up, and children born within 3 miles of a Superfund site have about 20% higher rates of birth defects. Well, New Jersey has the most Superfund sites, and back in the day, Ronald Reagan and Mitch McConnell voted for and reauthorized funding to clean these Superfund sites at a time that we were starting to shrink them. Well, those funding mechanisms have gone out. We're not investing in doing the kind of things.
So are you doing something to create a vast new pool of federal money to change the piping in school systems around the country?
My lessons in Newark before this most recent crisis sent me down to Washington to represent what I know about our urban areas, not only in Newark, not only in Camden, Passaic, Patterson, Trenton, but in our nation. And so I've introduced legislation, one, to create better public-private partnerships, to improve our infrastructure, which is right now, if we do not make the investments, Newark and Flint will not be anomalies. They are unfortunately all too real. And by the way, these are schools that the school systems we're now finding out has been testing. Well, there's lots of old, aged apartment buildings and other places where we're not testing in the private sector. So what I'm saying is, one, I've already pushed legislation now to start creating the funding mechanisms to do it. And two, for Superfund sites, which are toxic, Newark has Superfund sites, plural, that we need to start putting the federal dollars in to clean these sites up and return them to the tax rolls. And that's the powerful thing about doing the right thing. It's also the economically right thing. Because when you take away children's potential by allowing them to be lead poisoned, trust me, it costs so much more to deal with those children. When you return sites to the rolls, take them out of being toxic, and put them back on the tax rolls, you create economic development opportunities as well as creating more resources for the government to do more good. It's like running with common sense, which we need to return to in our country.
Let's talk about criminal justice reform. political leaders of both parties are now talking about reforming a broken criminal justice system. You've been talking about it for a couple of years. It's been probably a year since we saw you on PBS NewsHour with Rand Paul talking about legislation to create reform. Where does all of that stand? Did a bill ever get passed? Is anything happening?
So one, please know, I've got legislation on so many aspects of this, from ending what other countries call torture, juvenile solitary confinement, even to reforming our marijuana laws. There's now a major coalition in the Senate that has brought legislation. It passed out of the Judiciary Committee, and we're fighting to get it passed in this Congress on the floor of the Senate. At the same time, there's a reciprocal bill moving in the House. I'm in touch with the White House just about weekly.
Is it a tough sell?
It's a tough sell in a political climate that people want to demonize efforts to reform our criminal justice system, when they don't realize that since 1980 alone, our federal prison population has gone up 800%.
You wrote in the book that between 1990 and 2005, a new prison was built in America every 10 days. That's hard to believe.
It's a data point that is true. And please understand, at a time we weren't investing in our water infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, and our highways, other countries, understanding that that's critical for their economy, we're spiking in infrastructure investments. China, 4% of GDP they spend on infrastructure. Europe, twice what we spend. We've been disinvesting in infrastructure. Anybody who rides New Jersey Transit knows that. But the one part of infrastructure where we've been investing like no place on the planet Earth, where we seem to come up with the money, is in our prison infrastructure. And by the way, that is a black hole for tax dollars, because it's not making us safe. Actually, there are very good arguments that it's making us less safe, because one person who's now been arrested for a nonviolent drug offense for doing things the last two presidents admitted publicly to doing, now one arrest.
Marijuana?
No, the last two presidents admitted to doing drugs more serious than that, felonies, but they weren't convicted of it. But here in America, you're convicted of possession of heroin, of ecstasy, of cocaine. Please understand that you now can't get jobs, you can't get business licenses, you can't get Pell grants.
Everybody's talking about treating addiction as a disease and not as a crime, but not
the laws have not followed the sentiment. In some states they have. Some states have been able to lower their incarceration rates, increase addiction treatment, and what's happened to their crime? It's gone down. So what I'm saying is, the federal government, my very first policy conversation as I write in this book, I swore my oath of office on that hollow day of Halloween in 2013, turned around, one of the first hands I shook was Rand Paul, didn't let go of that hand. I said, we've got to work on pushing this issue. And so we've made progress, but a lot more has to be done, and more people have to be aware. Some of the great feedback I'm getting from my book is friends of mine who are very enlightened about policy were stunned by the data that they saw in the book around the broken criminal justice system and how much it's costing them as tax dollars, feeding in billions of dollars here in New Jersey into a broken system that's devastating communities. And here, let me give you this. Everybody talks about the Voting Rights Act and the Shelby decision, and it's creating a lot of attention on voting rights. Well, the biggest untold story in America about disenfranchising people is in the criminal justice system, where African Americans in swing states like Virginia and Florida, 1 in 5 have lost their voting rights because of felony disenfranchisement, majority of that nonviolent drug crimes.
You're right, that America has a caste system, and that African Americans are at the bottom of the caste.
Because as soon as you have an arrest, not even a conviction, most states it's legally, you can legally discriminate against somebody who's had an arrest, even if they've been cleared of charges. Blacks and whites have no difference between using drugs or dealing drugs, but African Americans are about 4 times more likely to be convicted of that, which means now they've been pushed aside in society where they can't get jobs, can't get Pell Grants, can't even get food stamps or public housing, and they're left with very little options. And then we wonder why people who have no economic options recidivate at levels of 75%.
We have a minute left. How optimistic are you that we can move on from a failed war on drugs?
Because American history is a perpetual testimony to the achievement of the impossible. We've overcome things like this before, but it's taken a level of activism and engagement, not from the top. That's why this important understanding, I wrote this book in response to what I heard from people campaigning all over the state. They lamented how divided our society is, how divided our politics. And I really want to take an examination of that. If you feel that way, nothing is going to change unless we do. and that we as individuals in this state and across our country have so much power. Alice Walker said the most common way we give up our power is not realizing we have it in the first place. And so I celebrate grassroots people, some people in New Jersey folks know, some they don't, who have shown their ability by understanding our connections, despite our differences matter, but our country matters more, who have made seemingly impossible transformations in their neighborhoods.
Senator Cory Booker, thanks so much for explaining what's in this book to us.
Thank you very much.
Enjoyed it very much.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back with a fresh program the weekend of April 2nd and 3rd and a fresh Reporters Roundtable. I'm Michael Aaron. Thanks for watching.
Major funding for On the Record with Michael Aaron is provided by the members of the New Jersey Education Association, making public schools great for every child. NJM, auto insurance and more, for New Jersey Business and Industry Association members, their employees, and all Garden State public sector workers. Rowan University, educating New Jersey leaders, partnering with New Jersey businesses, transforming New Jersey's future. And by the Fuel Merchants Association of New Jersey, the National Oil Heat Research Alliance, and BioHeat, the evolution of oil heat. Promotional support is provided by Politicker NJ, providing news and insight to New Jersey's political community.